Hey Lily, when we talk about strategy, you know, we always talk about initiatives and mission statements, and, you know, we just use a lot of words that are kind of boring. Have you ever wanted to go on a product quest?
Oh, that does sound a lot more exciting. But, you know, I'd probably be a bit worried that my team would be raided by orcs or schnaffled by dragons. Or were you going to go somewhere else with this?
No, you got me straight away, but I was not expecting schnaffled. We're chatting to Kenton Hansen this week from Roll20.net, and, you know, I got a bit carried away. Can you blame me?
Yes, I love playing games, but I also love doing user research, and Kenton spills the beans to us on how his team keeps user research in focus and some of the top tips from their work.
Okay, well, let's roll for initiative and see what kind of treasure we get from our chat with Kenton.
Oh, are you done with the cheese yet, Randy?
I'm never done with the cheese. The cheese just keeps coming. I'm really good with cheese. I'm dad jokes and cheese. That's pretty much all you get from me.
The product experience is brought to you by Mind the Product.
Every week, we talk to the best product people from around the globe about how we can improve our practice and build products that people love.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and to discover an extensive library of great content and videos.
Browse for free or become a Mind the Product member to unlock premium articles, unseen videos, AMAs, roundtables, discounts to our conferences around the world, training opportunities, and more.
Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities, and there's probably one near you. Kenton, welcome to the Product Experience. It's so great to be talking to you today.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
So we're going to chat to you today all about user research and how to do it well.
Great.
But before we get stuck into the topic, if you could give us a real quick intro into your origin story as a product person, kind of how you got into it and also what you're up to today.
Sure. So it all started for me when I was going through an abandoned factory and I fell into a vat of toxic waste. May not be the origin story you're looking for. No, I actually got into product inadvertently, which I think is not that uncommon, especially in the stories I've heard. I was working basically building you know, people websites for marketing purposes and getting into the marketing aspects of that. But as programming and scripting and Ruby on Rails really helped with this, I got into the technical side, and I'm not a very good developer. So focusing in on the product and trying to define the problem and help people find the solution was much more exciting to me. And my first real big product experience was in 2007. I really started diving into an internal tool for a company that sold admissions basically to different events around the United States. And from there, taught myself and learned a lot and applied it back to business school education.
And today?
Today. Yeah. So today, I'm the director of product at Roll20, which is a software as a service, completely web-based way to play tabletop role-playing games and, you know, other tabletop games in a virtual environment. You can play with your friends around the globe just like they were sitting at your kitchen table. So I do a lot with Dungeons & Dragons, Call of Cthulhu, or Pathfinder, those kinds of games.
Awesome. So I bet you've had a good year with the state of the world.
The way I like to say it is that we were incredibly lucky to provide a way to distract from the realities of the world and still connect with your friends in a socially distanced way. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was a privilege to serve that purpose for a lot of people.
So let's start talking about user research. Let's kind of start with the main challenges of, you know, what stops people from doing good user research.
I think one of the biggest challenges is the blank page syndrome of how do we get started? What do we do? There's so many different ways you can slice the data, segment the audiences, that it becomes overwhelming even to get started. So the first thing that I like to tell, especially, you know, people on my team or the people that I coach, is just to get started. Ask a question. Any question that you ask is one step further along the process. And that's the first hurdle. Get a question out of the way, and it'll help you define what questions you need to ask later on. The next one, I think, that approaches is focusing on what kind of results you're looking for. And that is one reason why I say just ask a first question. The kinds of answers you get back help define the questions that you want to ask in the future, and help you move along the user research path. You're kind of doing user research for your product and the way that it works for your team even. And then finally, overcoming the myths. And this is a fun one, because all organizations work off some decision-making criteria. For organizations who are making decisions without user research, there is a myth that gets told within the organization. This is how people do a thing. Oh, when our users come to us, this is the path that they take. And that gets told over and over again until where it's believed internally, and you have to fight the myth with the data and prove it over and over again. So getting traction with your data, even after you've done the user research and you can point to the results you expect, you have to continually hit those and make that a pattern of behavior rather than a one-off event.
It sounds like you're doing a mix of qualitative and quantitative when you do this. How do you put those two together? What are you looking from each?
For me, it really depends on the state of that particular product or that particular even feature sometimes, the initiative that the product team is focused on. I think that qualitative and quantitative has to be together, like they're siblings. You can't approach one without the other. You can make a qualitative decision. I like to, it is a joke. I want to make sure that everyone understands that. But I always say I can reduce subscriptions in our product by removing the cancel button. If users don't have a way to do that, qualitatively, we would reduce our subscriptions down to almost zero. Reduce our cancellations down to almost zero. However, I think qualitatively, that would have more negative impact than you could possibly imagine. So they are married. I kind of feel like that's a non-answer, but it's a very situational and situationally aware decision to make whether you want to be in that. I think, as I said, product lifecycle and where you are in that stage, early in the product lifecycle, you're looking for acceptance and you're looking for use, and qualitative results are much more important early in the stage, whereas qualitative comes later when you're, especially at the scale, you know, when you're looking at actual business metrics.
And tell us a bit about how you do user research at Roll20. Like, who owns that part of things, and how do you schedule it in or decide where you're focusing? And
So user research is a shared ownership for sure. There's not any one person who it belongs to. Each product manager is responsible for the research on the changes that they're scheduled to be making, that they're researching, and setting a baseline for how they expect users to interact with those changes. The methods are, you know, very similar to probably what any high functioning product organization is doing. You know, we talk to users, we reach out to them and schedule conversations with them. We put up surveys in the user experience through the process and kind of inject that in a place where people can opt in to give that information. We send out emails with links to surveys and incentivize those in various ways in order to get information back. Most of the time, those help us stratify the users, and then we'll take those subsets, the cohorts that we find in there, and ask the questions that we're asking for those. NPS score is a very important tool that we use, and we measure it regularly in order to determine, you know, how well are we doing, first of all, but then second of all, how each of those users might respond to a change or a problem that we're trying to solve for them.
Do you do these things at kind of the gross level, you know, the mass level, or do you do them in terms of segments or cohorts? And if you do it in segments and cohorts, and how do you qualify them?
So yes, both. We do them in mass scales in order to understand where the segmentation lines come in our total audience, first of all. So once we stratify our users, we'll approach each cohort in a certain way. For a particular change, we may be trying to help the users who are very involved. They've been a subscriber for a long time, and we want to make a change to make it easier for them in some way. We'll focus in on those people. There's a lot of changes that we're making on making the onboarding experience easier and more convenient. And so we don't need to talk to our veterans, the people who've already done the onboarding. We need to talk to the people who maybe have never even used the software before. And that's how we break those down. Those are the two that I'm thinking of in my head. But we also look at, you know, subscribership, you know, other purchases, different interactions that they've had in critical user journeys is a term that's being thrown around a lot right now. We look at those and who's accomplished them or who hasn't. And then we may end up asking, why haven't you? Or how was that experience? Those kinds of things.
So, you know, when you have such a large audience as you do at Roll20 and you're kind of, you know, you're deciding who you want to talk to, when you're doing a more sort of generic, you know, we want to speak to people who have played Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. How do you go about sort of qualifying the user before you perform the research? What kinds of questions are you asking at that point?
It's wide and varied for sure. And so I can't say like one particular set of questions in any given time. Mm. But one of the steps that we do to help create that is before we do any user research, before we do even something as simple as a survey, we take a couple steps. First of all, we identify our hypothesis, right? Like we're going to be asking a question and we think that we're going to find X. You know, so we're going to ask how many people have played Dungeons and Dragons in the past 30 days. And we think we're going to find 50% of people that we ask will have said this is something that they've done on our platform. By identifying those, we call out our own biases. And the second step that we do is once we've set that hypothesis, we then identify other biases that may be in our question. That helps identify what cohorts we need to find and what steps we need to take to make sure that our large audience that we, you know, the large ocean that we can pull from gets sorted down into a representative sample and breaks apart the unintentional biases that we may be coming up against. So we don't oversample, you know, this particular day of the week in which we have found a lot of people play one particular game, or we don't oversample in another area that would taint the data and give us research that wouldn't be actionable very well.
One of the things I always worry about when inviting people for user research interviews is that you are, by the very method that you're doing the interview, you end up with people who are happy to talk about, you know, what they're doing and stuff like that. Do you find that that's a problem, or like, do you have the same concerns?
It for sure is a concern. And I think it is good to connect any person that you're talking with, you're interviewing, that you're researching with some of the other metrics that you may have collected earlier. That's one way. Now, that takes a lot of work and a lot of planning, right? And so I don't think it's the most important thing, because at the same time, you're going to get you get the people who are very willing to talk to you, but some people are very willing to talk to you when they're extremely happy. Other people are very willing to talk to you when they're extremely not happy. I think it's that middle section that's actually the hardest to get to. And the middle section is a lot of times where the most juice is ready for the squeeze too, of getting, you know, the person who's like, oh, this is fine, I'd be happy, you know, it would be amazing if this, right? Like, we don't find those insights nearly as readily. So some kind of the incentive actually taints the data in a different way. But yeah, I am very worried about that too.
So is this like a Olympic diving where you take all the scores that come in, all the interviews that come in, you throw away the top rated one, you throw away the bottom rated one, and you work on the ones in the middle?
Almost always, yeah. The people who are leaving glowing reviews are have something else baked into it. The people who are leaving the most negative reviews are typically have something else going on in their life that is making things more difficult for them. And somewhere in the middle, there's that section. I mean, from an NPS store, NPS score perspective, I am much more interested in the sevens and eights than I am in the zeros and ones. Absolutely.
That makes sense. Those are the people that are reachable and convertible, and the zeros and ones. I mean, if they keep using the product and they're a zero or a one.
Why? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. You don't need to do this. Like, I mean, I appreciate the support, but maybe you'd be happier somewhere else.
Maybe they're just having a really bad day anyway.
Yeah.
And you kind of hinted at this earlier, but one of the things we were going to talk about tonight was the different kinds of research that you do throughout the life cycle of a company. And how kind of qual is probably a little bit more important early on than quant. But how do you see the different phases that a company goes through and the different focuses that you need to have throughout those different phases?
Sure. So when I break down the product life cycle in the different stages, I look at problem solution as like the first stage, where you're really trying to define what is there a problem that's worth solving, and is the solution viable to solve it? And in that stage, I'm looking for adoption and usage, right? Like, this is where we have completely free services or a beta service, or I'm just trying to get people to adopt the thing that I'm making and put it in their lives and accept it as one of their own. As that starts to, as you get the adoption that you're looking for and you set those goals, I move into the product market fit, right? And at that point, asking for money becomes an issue, or driving sales. And I'm thinking about this from a direct to customer type sales, you know, in B2B, it's much more sales driven. And so you end up doing these as a mix. At the point of product market fit, I'm looking for happiness and acceptance, and beyond just like, will they adopt it and will they put it into their use case at any given point in the day? Are they happy about doing it? Are they putting it into their user experience? Are they adopting it into their lives more so? Reluctantly, is this just what I have to use, or am I excited about using it? Social networks fall in that for me right now. I want to know what's up with my friends and family, but goodness, I don't want to be on a social network anymore. That really doesn't add much to my life. Is there a market for the product? As you move into the business model fit, you start to be able to hone your pricing strategies and the value transfer that actually happens there. And then also as you get into scale of like dumping money into marketing to get the largest audience to see the solution that you've tested and works and everything else, you're looking at typical business metrics, you know, your balance sheet type metrics, profitability, sales numbers. That's really where it shifts from the happiness and acceptance to cold hard cash.
Sprig, formerly UserLeap, is an all-in-one product research platform that lets you ask bite-sized questions to your customers within your product or existing user journeys.
Companies like Dropbox, Square, Opendoor, Loom, and Shift all use Sprig's video interviews, concept tests, and micro surveys to understand their customers at the pace of modern software development so they can build customer-centric products that deliver a sustainable competitive advantage.
So if you're part of an agile product team that wants to obtain rich insights from users at the pace you ship products, then give Sprig a try for free by visiting sprig.com. Again, that's Sprig, Sprig.com. So one of the things I found because I've worked with quite a lot of early stage startups, is that in doing that very early stage research, it can be sort of much easier to get the people to talk to you when you say that you're building this brand new thing and it hasn't been launched yet and you want to have a chat with them and show them some stuff. And then as you begin to grow, you obviously get your early adopters, but then you get your people who are just like, no, I just want to like come in, do my thing and then leave. Mm-hmm. So that bit, and you kind of hinted at this again earlier, of those people who are, you know, they're not like super engaged, high, early adopter types, but they're also not like desperately unhappy. Like, do you have any sort of strategies for trying to get to those people and get to research with them?
So what I have found, and this is actually like career long findings, is that when you're trying to focus in on that middle mass, really, and most users are going to be there. If we're talking about a giant user base, or we're talking about even an internal product, right, that nobody has an option to use, everyone has to use this thing, but are you happy about it, becomes the metric. That middle section, you can't use the automated methods, right? Like, you can't use, or not nearly as easily, use an automated method to just throw a survey up or send an email and expect that you're going to have to reach out and make a human connection with those people. And once you can make a human connection with those people, usually there's a way to convince them, even if it's just a few quick questions. And then it really becomes part of a sales technique in a lot of ways, of the same techniques that one might use in a sales scenario, I guess is what I mean, where you have a relationship with them, you can check in with them regularly, and you essentially move them up the scale if things go well, of like, oh, I'm in this middle mass, but now I'm a promoter. They listen to me, they take my, and then you have to go start all over again and find the people in the middle again. As long as you have usage metrics, and that's one of the reasons why at an early stage, the usage is the most important part to measure, is that as you move through the life cycle, you can segment by the amount of use that someone has. So someone might be using a whole lot, but they don't interact with the automated surveys. That's probably your middle mass that you need to really hone in on and focus on.
Okay. So one of the challenges for people who do lots of research is you do lots of research. There's just a lot of data that you have. How do you store it? How do you share it? How do you ensure that you actually realize value from it and people are able to, you know, make use of the corpus of information?
So I'm going to rely on the collective intelligence of the internet to chasten me for not writing down where I found this from. But somewhere on the internet, I believe there's a tweet probably from an influencer that we're all reading if we're reading product stuff, talked about a change in the way that they were storing their findings. This came up naturally in the product and user experience design teams at Roll 20. And oh my goodness, it's been amazing. It's been life-changing. So I want the collective intelligence to scold me for not remembering who it is and tell us who it was who came up with this. But what we've done is we've changed from basically storing in our wiki or our Confluence or wherever we're putting these insights. We're storing the insight that we found. So it may be one user interview that says, boy, I'd like it if that button were purple instead of pink for some reason. We store it and title it, this button should be purple, not pink, and then link to the user research, that the artifact that was created for that. So it may be a recording to the interview, or it may be the write-up for that interview, or maybe a survey. But once we have enough of that information, it starts to surface the most popular and most important findings that we'd have in that way. That's been changing for us. Our Confluence has been amazing since then.
And is that only based on the user research that you commission, or is it also coming from other places? Like, do support teams put in from their tickets? And, you're not B2B sales, but, you know, in that case, it would be mm-hmm. salespeople. Would that be considered just as valid?
Yeah, we have to be a little bit more careful about that, because we're interacting with a kind of a different system. You know, our ticketing, our trouble ticketing system needs to be filtered into that way. But it would be just as valid to link to this problem created, 100 user created tickets over the course of the last week. And so we put that finding up there. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Randy, about the insights that we commission are worth probably one third of the insights that come in through a natural state, until they're not. But, you know, those are incredibly valuable. The general work that happens is just as good as user research that we commission. And I think that answering trouble tickets for a product manager is worth its weight in gold. Time doesn't have weight, but if it did, it would be heavy, I assume.
And then so you've got just a steady stream of digestible, let's call them tweets or nuggets.
Right.
And how do you surface that? Is there like a Slack channel for that? Do you broadcast it out, or what do you do with them?
We actually have a Confluence space that has this information associated with it, and with the right labels, it gets put into this place. The things that are more often, the time red is what I use to look at it. So as more is added to it, the time red goes up. So it, it takes 3 minutes to read this. It takes 7 minutes to read this. Oh, wow, this is really important. Let's take a look at this. The other problem, the other way is through like the problem solution discovery. When these are problems, but sometimes they're solutions to problems we are only now just discovering. So connecting those discovered items back to a solution that we're looking at because we found this other problem helps reduce the need to do additional user research because we've already found these through the natural course of either commissioned or accidental user research.
I like that method. That sounds good. Okay, so we were talking about myth busting earlier. So the general consensus, I believe, on the internet is that you should talk to your customers every week. And I just want to ask, as a business that's doing user research well, do you actually talk to your customers every week?
And... Wait, there's consensus on the internet?
Maybe not.
I think this is a myth that may need to be busted.
Okay, yes. Thank you, please.
I don't like, I think framework serve a purpose, absolutely. And this is a framework, right? As I mentioned before, the first and biggest hurdle is just getting started. The overhead of talking to your customers and it is different for every business. For us, we listen more than we talk. We listen to our users every day, absolutely. The product managers on my team are looking, we're looking at social media. And I think this is another benefit that direct-to-consumer businesses have, right? If you're talked about on social media, you can hear that as long as you've got a thick enough skin for it. We also have, the community aspect. We have forums and there are Discord servers or Slack channels or Reddit has a wealth of information for us from the TTRPG standpoint, tabletop role-playing game, sorry. All of those come together into kind of this stream that you can dip your toe into and learn, right? And then regularly is the key. You need to actively reach out and have conversations with your users. Weekly, yeah, I mean, that's regular. But I feel like you could do the same thing monthly, right? And if you're talking to your users and that takes an hour and a half per week, you could do the same thing in a day per month and pull that out. You just need to solve for your own biases again, right? Like writing down the hypothesis and solve for the biases that come up.
So when you're getting ready to do these interviews in the first place, how do you decide on what topics or questions you want to ask? How do you know what's the right thing to conduct research on that week? Well, or not week.
Right. That time in that interview. That has, from a specific standpoint, we have some strategic initiatives at any given time that we're working towards, right? Both quarterly and longer term, as well as shorter term. There are different pieces of strategy that we're trying to accomplish, different tactics that we're implementing at any given time. And those pieces are really going to define the questions that we ask. Tying it to, anyone putting this in any organization, any product organization, starting with product strategy, right? What is the product strategy and how are we trying to affect that? Connecting that directly into your key performance indicators or your OKRs, right? Like how are we applying product strategy to the day-to-day, to the things that we're releasing to next week and the week after, or hopefully, next month and the month after. And let's ask the questions that help us move that needle. What worked? What didn't? And what can we ask our users about in order to work better next time?
Just please tell me you don't use that terminology. I mean, you're Roll 20. You've got to have strategic quests or missions, not initiatives, right?
the organization as a whole subscribed to some concepts by Patrick Lencioni. And so they're not nearly as interesting as you might think. We do have the marketing team, and I absolutely love this. They have spells that they cast. So different specifics that they'll do to help promote the product and content that we're selling at any given time. I'm sorry to disappoint. sometimes clarity is better than branding, I guess, is really what I'm trying to say.
Form over function, or no, hang on, right. Function over form.
Something, one of those two.
Okay, and then, so just thinking about user research interviews particularly, how do you prepare for those and then go about conducting them? Like, what are your top tips for doing the actual interviews themselves?
Yeah, so I mentioned the defining the hypothesis, and you know that necessitates defining the question that we're trying to ask, and then what we hypothesize the answer we're going to get back. Diving into the biases that we have internally, which uncovers some of those myths again that we need to be aware of. Those are all the first steps. Absolutely, I highly recommend Erica Hall's book, Just Enough Research. I think it's one of the best textbook examples of just like getting your feet wet and understanding the lightest possible framework in order to do user research. And then from there, from her book, one of the pieces that I think is really good is just writing a couple open-ended questions that you definitely want to ask and letting the interviewee talk, right? Every once in a while, you'll need to do some prompting. And since you've got the one or two questions, you can use those to leverage that again. But you're going to learn a whole lot more from the question you didn't know you needed to ask than you are from 50 questions that you really want to get in there.
Awesome. That's great. Kenton, it's been so amazing talking to you tonight about user research. I love it.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, it's been fantastic. I've learned a lot.
Good. I've had an excellent time. Thank you both.
I am so disappointed that their product teams use the same old boring language as the rest of us.
But the marketing team get to cast spells. They are living the dream.
And so are we, because we're back next week with another amazing guest. See you then.
Our hosts are me, Lily Smith, and
me, Randy Silver.
Emily Tate is our producer, and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's P-A-U. Thanks to Arne Kittler, who runs Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. Connect with your local product community via Product Tank, our regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, you can consider starting one yourself. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/Product Tank.
Product Tank is a global community of meetups driven by and for product people. We offer expert talks, group discussion, and a safe environment for product people to come together and share learnings and tips.